The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. And we'll start today with, born out of national division, O Little Town of Bethlehem is a balm for Christmas. This story was written by Karen Swallow Pryor. One Sunday morning, a pastor steps up to his pulpit, and amid the swirling chaos of a country divided and mourning, preaches a eulogy for a felled leader and for our crumbling nation. The preacher turns prophet when he says, "The more we see of events, the less we come to believe in any fate or destiny, except the destiny of character." It is Sunday, April 23rd, 1865, and the sermon, delivered at Church of the Holy Trinity in Philadelphia by Philip Brooks, is titled "The Life and Death of Abraham Lincoln." But what follows isn't the story of the Civil War, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, or the sermon. It isn't the story of how viciously polarized our nation was then or is today. This is the story of how all of these events contributed to one of today's most enduring and beloved carols, O Little Town of Bethlehem. It's also the story of how one response to despair can be to make beauty from ashes, to sing the world toward greater faith and hope. Brooks, author of A Little Town of Bethlehem, lived from 1835 to 1893. After graduating from Harvard University, he attended Virginia Theological Seminary and was ordained in the Episcopal Church in 1860. He became rector at Church of the Holy Trinity not long after, entering ministry just as the nation was plunging into civil war. Brooks was outspoken against slavery and favored waging war against seceding states, views that divided not only the nation, but even his own congregation. He was a towering figure, reportedly standing 6'4" tall. His sermons were as commanding as his stature, and he was considered to be one of the greatest preachers of his day. During the Civil War, he took on the role of chaplain at Gettysburg, traveling weekly by train from Philadelphia to Gettysburg and back. His sermons and lectures brought him and his church national attention, and his eulogy to Lincoln, preached in his home church, was widely read after being published. The war, the sharp division inside and outside the church, the death of Lincoln, and the death of one of Brooks' brothers from typhoid fever, contracted while serving in the Union Army, left the mighty preacher exhausted and depleted. In While Mortals Sleep, published in June, Rachel Winner Gardner relays how, mourning for his lost brother, the country's lost president and the nation itself, Brooks began a year-long sabbatical in 1865, setting off on a much-needed break for Europe and the Holy Land. On Christmas of 1865, Brooks traveled on horseback from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. On that pilgrimage, he rode out to the field where it is said, "The shepherds saw the star and heard the angels heralding the birth of Jesus." Then he participated in a Christmas Eve service at the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. 3 years later, back home in Philadelphia, Brooks presented a little Christmas poem he had written for the Sunday school children about his Christmas in Bethlehem. He presented it to the church organist and asked if the organist could set it to music. That's how A Little Town of Bethlehem was sung for the first time on December 27, 1868. Christians haven't stopped singing it since, voicing each season an appeal to the Child of Bethlehem to descend to us once more. It is striking that such a simple, soothing carol, written for children, yet full of rich theology and metaphor, could be born of such a terrible loss. But it is not surprising. In a 1999 article in The Atlantic, poet Robert Pinsky, a former laureate of the United States, described the connection between the peaceful Bethlehem Brooks encountered and the war-savaged home country he left for a while and returned to. After the war ended, Pinsky wrote, "Many little towns of the North and the South were unnaturally silent because so many of the young men were gone. The hopes and fears of all the years involve the Republic itself, and in that context the town's deep and dreamless sleep beneath the silent stars is the more unsettling, precisely because it is dreamless and therefore deathlike." One biographer wrote of Brooks' Christian belief, "For Brooks, the final, non-negotiable bedrock doctrine was the Incarnation, God the Father sending his eternal Son, the Logos, to be born in first-century Palestine, was the heart and soul of the Christian message. Without the Incarnation, there really was no gospel to preach." There is, a century and a half after Brooks wrote this haunting carol, much once again, indeed always, to lament, fear, and grieve. Brooks, despite his position of power and influence, perhaps even because of it, felt deeply the sources of these things in his own lifetime. He carried weighty burdens on his mighty shoulders, bore them across the sea, over hill, desert, and dale, and back again. He emerged, in the end, faithful and hopeful, and he shared the source of that faith and hope to generations that followed, and generations yet to come. May we who feel great burdens for our church, our nation, for the world, do likewise. Next, how a niche Catholic approach to infertility treatment became a new talking point for MAHA conservatives. This was written by Emma Kennedy, assistant professor of Christian ethics from Villanova University. Along the 2024 presidential campaign trail, Donald Trump pledged to make in vitro fertilization, or IVF, free, part of his party's wider push for a new American baby boom. But in October of 2025, when the administration revealed its IVF proposal, many healthcare experts pointed out that it falls short of mandating insurance companies to cover the procedure. Since Trump returned to the White House, it has become clear just how fraught IVF is for his base. Some conservative Christians oppose IVF because it involves destroying extra embryos not implanted in the woman's uterus. According to Politico, anti-abortion groups lobbied against a requirement for employers to cover IVF. Instead, some vouched for restorative reproductive medicine, a term that has been around for decades but has received much more attention, especially from conservatives, in the past few months. Proponents of restorative reproductive medicine tend to present it as an alternative to IVF, a different way of treating infertility, focused on treating underlying causes. But the approach is controversial, and some practitioners closely link their treatments to Catholic teachings. As a scholar of religion, I study U.S. Catholics' varied perspectives on infertility, seeking to understand how religious beliefs and practices influence physicians' and patients' choices. Their perspectives help to provide a more nuanced understanding of Christianity's role in the U.S. reproductive and political landscape. Clinics that advertise themselves as offering restorative reproductive medicine try to diagnose underlying issues that could make conception difficult, like endometriosis. Typically, a patient and provider will closely monitor the patient's menstrual cycle to identify potential abnormalities. Interventions include hormone therapies, medications, supplements, surgeries, and lifestyle changes. Much of the approach resembles the initial testing used to evaluate patients in mainstream reproductive endocrinology and infertility clinics. However, restorative reproductive medicine clinics do not typically offer IVF or other assisted reproductive technologies. Depending on who you ask, proponents are not necessarily opposed to IVF. They see their treatments as another option to explore. Some clinicians, however, closely link their treatment offerings to their religious commitments and opposition to abortion. Restorative reproduction medicine has prompted criticism from professional medical organizations. The American Society for Reproductive Medicine issued a statement in May 2025 calling it a, quote, rebranding, unquote, of standard infertility treatment with ideological-driven restrictions that could limit patient care. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists issued a brief warning that it is a non-medical approach that threatens to impede access to IVF. These critics are concerned that the focus on lifestyle changes and surgery may not address patients' difficulties conceiving while putting them through other unsuccessful treatments. Today, restorative reproductive medicine is often described as gaining steam with conservative Christians and the Make America Healthy Again, or MAHA, movement. Its roots, though, are decades old and largely Catholic. Part of the Catholic Church's objection to IVF stems from a current concern that unused embryos are often discarded and destroyed. The Church's position is that all embryos ought to be treated with the same respect afforded a person, one of the key reasons its teachings oppose abortion. Disapproval of IVF also stems from the Church's official teaching on marriage. According to this teaching, marriage has two chief ends, which it calls procreation and union. Typically, procreation is understood to mean having children, while union involves physical, emotional, and spiritual intimacy. In this understanding, sexual intercourse should preserve what the Church calls an inseparable connection between these two meanings. The Catholic Church opposes artificial contraception because its goal is to block procreation. Instead, Catholics are in turn encouraged to use natural family planning, tracking a woman's cycle so that couples can choose to abstain from sex during fertile periods. Similarly, it opposes artificial insemination and IVF because, by moving fertilization out of the body and into the lab, the process separates procreation from the act of sexual intercourse. Survey data suggests most U.S. Catholics do not agree with these official stances, nor do they follow them. Catholic doctors who do agree with official Church teachings, however, have played a key role in developing infertility treatments that align with them. One of the most influential is Dr. Thomas W. Hilgers, who co-developed a natural family planning method called the Creighton model. In the early 1990s, he also developed NAPRO technology, an approach that seeks to identify fertility issues using cycle tracking and then treat them with various medical and surgical interventions. The NAPRO technology approach could be said to fall under the umbrella of restorative reproductive medicine, but it has mostly been used by Catholic reproductive health clinics and hospitals. Catholic physicians networks promote it, as do parishes and dioceses. For Catholics who share the Church's official perspective on IVF, NAPRO technology and the clinics offering it are often a welcome alternative. Several of the Catholic women I interviewed as part of my academic research had also been to mainstream fertility clinics, but they felt that those providers did not offer much apart from IVF. By contrast, the clinics offering NAPRO technology were often cheaper, in part because they do not offer IVF. They were also easier to navigate since clinicians shared these patients' religious views. Many felt that the providers were able to spend more time with them, help them learn about their bodies, and were committed to understanding underlying issues beyond infertility. However, others found clinics offering NAPRO technology to be lacking, often because clinicians weren't upfront about its limitations, especially when it comes to male infertility. Some patients felt the clinicians weren't willing to admit drawbacks, for fear it would encourage couples to try IVF. Most Catholics dealing with infertility, however, find themselves in mainstream clinical settings that offer IVF. Women I interviewed who opted for IVF were frank in their critiques about church teachings and their skepticism of Catholic clinics. Many took issue with the underlying assumption that the people who ought to be procreating are heterosexual married couples, and that conception is usually possible without the help of IVF. However, many of these women were also dissatisfied with the approach that mainstream clinics take. Some felt that those clinics were focused on profit, a concern shared by some scholars scrutinizing the fertility industry. Some women also felt pressured to genetically test their embryos for chromosomal abnormalities and to discard unused embryos, even after explaining to staff that destroying them would be out of step with their moral commitments. Understanding patient experiences in either kind of clinic helps underscore the difficulties many people face navigating infertility and the stakes of policy reform. The Trump administration's plan largely maintains the status quo for IVF access while making more room for alternative treatments. But it intensifies questions about how the government responds to religious beliefs about reproductive health care, especially disagreements about the moral status of embryos. For now, patients and providers will continue to navigate a fractured landscape. New Jersey religious activists call for investigation after ICE detainee's death. This story written by Fiona Murphy from Newark, New Jersey. Faith leaders and religious advocates in New Jersey are calling for accountability and compassion following the death of a 41-year-old Haitian man after a reported medical emergency while he was detained at Delaney Hall, an immigration detention facility in Newark. It marks the first recorded death at the detention center since it reopened in May amid the Trump administration's mass deportation campaign. Delaney Hall is operated by private prison company GEO Group under contract with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE confirmed the death of John Wilson Brutus in a statement on December 18th, saying he entered ICE custody on December 11th after he was released from Union County Jail in Elizabeth, New Jersey, which followed an arrest for criminal mischief, damage to property. The agency said Brutus died of suspected natural causes on December 12th. While at Delaney Hall Detention Facility, he experienced a medical emergency, and local emergency medical services was called, ICE said in a news release. EMS performed life-saving measures and transported Brutus to University Hospital in Newark, and later the hospital pronounced him deceased on December 12th. The statement described Brutus as a, quote, criminal illegal alien, end quote, and said that ICE notified federal oversight authorities and the Haitian consulate of his death, as required by agency policy. The agency stated it is committed to ensuring that all those in custody reside in safe, secure, and humane environments. On Friday, December 19th, advocates and volunteers with the Eyes on ICE initiative issued a statement calling for an immediate independent investigation into Brutus's death and greater transparency from immigration officials. The coalition includes faith leaders and community groups that have maintained near-daily vigils outside Delaney Hall to support families and monitor conditions at the facility, which houses about 1,100 inmates. Some volunteers took photos of an ambulance arriving at Delaney Hall, possibly to assist Brutus on December 11th. Citing a Freedom of Information Act request from Scripps News, the advocate statement said there were 12 emergency calls to Delaney Hall between September 1 and November 17th, and argued that ICE's decision to post public notice about Brutus's death a week after it occurred underscores ongoing concerns about oversight and accountability. Kathy O'Leary, a leader of Pax Christi New Jersey, a Catholic peace organization, said she is typically present outside Delaney Hall 3 to 4 days a week and was there the night of December 11th, but left before the incident unfolded. When I was there, there were people coming up to us, people who had some kind of connection to the inside of the building, who were really concerned about a man who, several nights before, had a seizure and had to have an emergency tracheotomy performed on him, O'Leary said. This is also not the first time that we've heard of seizures inside the building. O'Leary said a network of volunteers documented facility events in real time through photos, videos, and a group chat. Advocates said they first became aware of ICE's public notice of the death on December 19th and released their statement the same day. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security, which oversees ICE, did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Religious leaders said the death raises serious moral questions about responsibility and how human life is valued inside detention. Sister Susan Franco, a Catholic sister who regularly volunteers outside Delaney Hall and documents her witness on TikTok, said Brutus's death was inevitable. I've heard from the visiting family members that many regular medical conditions are not treated promptly and not treated well, she said. So I think it's going to be inevitable. I think that we need to raise the moral outrage, Frankos added. The fact that they waited. He died a week ago. They waited until a holiday weekend to release the news with this very unchristian, unhuman demonizing of this gentleman. The Reverend Shannon Smythe, a Presbyterian minister who volunteers outside Delaney Hall, said she hopes Brutus's death forces political leaders to intervene. I hope it's a turning point, but we need people with power who can stop this and say, get GEO out of our state. Get it out of Newark, she said. We need those people with power to speak up, as activists and clergy and people with basic moral consciences have been. O'Leary said that honoring Brutus's dignity means refusing to let him become anonymous. I think it's important that we use his name and not talk about him only as, quote, the man who died, end quote, O'Leary said. We need to recognize his humanity. We need to remember he was a person. Delaney Hall reopened earlier this year under a long-term federal contract and has been the subject of protests, legal disputes, and repeated allegations from advocates about dangerous and dehumanizing conditions. Frankos said witnessing families suffer outside the facility has heightened her concern and faithful devotion. Of visitors who wait in a shed-like structure at the facility to visit inmates, she said, I cannot help but think about how there was no room in the inn for Jesus. Our next story is a book review, Joy Within His House, Making Sense of Life in a Monastery. This was written by Elizabeth E. Evans. Sister Mary Magdalene of the Immaculate Conception Prewitt, a 38-year-old nun in the Dominican Order, is often asked how she got from her upbringing in Kansas to life in a monastery in New Jersey. In a new book, Joy Within His House, Prewitt explains, tracing her path from college in Pittsburgh, Kansas, to an enclosed monastery in Summit, New Jersey, where she spends her time in a community of women ages 22 to 93, give or take the occasional visitor exploring their own possible vocation to contemplative life. But the ambitious book about prayer, vocational discernment, and monastery life is much more than an autobiography. But instead, she offers a primer on what it means to lead a contemplative life in the Dominican Order's tradition, from the times of prayer to recreation to what it means spiritually to be cloistered. The volume includes evocative monastery snapshots. She also cites not only a variety of Christian scriptures, but Catholic teaching and a surprising number of novels, including classics such as Middlemarch, The Brothers Karamazov, and Anna Karenina, but also Sigrid Udstedt's Nobel Prize-winning Kristen Lavrandatter, a historical trilogy about an unconventional young Norwegian woman set in the 1400s. Her hope in writing the book, she said, was to make fundamentals of monastery life more accessible to lay people. She writes about many familiar moments in the least religious readers can relate to, including medical checkups and emergency care and grocery shopping. What led you to write Joy Within the House? People have so many misconceptions about the cloister. Part of the reason for wanting to write the book is really to help people understand something they don't understand and often have erroneous ideas about, but also to give them the principles to grow closer to the Lord that the monastery has made so accessible. What brought you to the monastery? In college, I started thinking about what I wanted to do with my life. I began spending more time in prayer. I started really asking the Lord what He wanted me to do with my life. I began to see things I thought were where I wanted to go, but I don't think I would have actually been very happy doing. The unfolding of my vocation really took place by spending time in prayer and asking the Lord where He was leading me and seeing how I could be happy in this way of life, but also grow in holiness. What makes your life different from that of a prayerful lay Christian? All Christians are called to union with God. In a lot of ways, contemplatives, either male or female, are different because of the enclosure, the intentional separation from the world to focus exclusively on that goal. There are wonderful, beautiful opportunities intentionally built into the day to be set aside for prayer and to be working for God, to be growing closer to one another in creation, and to focus on that goal. How do you know what a particular events or people to pray for? It's a matter of just listening to the Holy Spirit. You feel inclined to hold on to certain intentions. On a practical level, you can't always be praying for everybody's intentions. Intentions have to either be general or specific. I can pray for all prisoners, but I can also think of a woman who is a friend of the community whose son is in prison. But it's also just good to pray for those who need prayers. I think the Holy Spirit just really leads you in that way. Sometimes you can spend 10 minutes reading the prayer board, and there's just one prayer that you really remember that really sticks to you. I think the Lord sorts all that out. I was intrigued by the classic novels and works of great literature you mention in your book. One of the most famous works of literature in human history is St. Augustine's Confessions. That's really the story of his life, but his experience is on every single page. The beauty of that work is that the entire thing is a prayer written to God, yet it is the rawness of Augustine's experience that we're allowed to enter into. I think literature especially has a way of capturing in art what we sometimes can't explain. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired.